In my records, I haven't gone through them here. Ruth is a Gentile that marries a Jew, and Esther is a Jew that marries a Gentile. So we'll go through the book of Ruth. There's some really good practical things in here. Probably the biggest thing that you're going to get in here, she lives during a very bad time, but she's a very virtuous woman. So that tells us that your environment cannot be used as an excuse for your character. So no matter how bad it gets, a person can still live right and live holy, and a lady can be virtuous. And that's Ruth. Okay, so we'll go ahead and pray. Lord, I do ask you to help us understand your words. And I do ask you to help us to learn from this wonderful lady's testimony. And help us to understand that we can also glean some things from her testimony and the record that you've given us. It's a very short book, only four chapters. And I pray you'd help us to know how to apply some of these things. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, the book of Ruth. Okay, right off the bat, it says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled." Okay, so what does that tell us? Right off the bat, so you go backwards one page and look at the last verse in the book of Judges. Okay, it's amazing in the Bible how quickly man can go down to tubes. Okay, when you go through the seven churches of Revelation, you'll have Ephesus, you know, Smyrna, Pergamos, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia. Philadelphia is the one that's credited the best. So that in our history, that would be the Reformation into the 1700s, 1800s, with the great revivals. And then Laodicea, it goes from Philadelphia to Laodicea that quick. And it usually only takes one or two generations for society to go bonkers. Okay, and at the beginning of your Bible, you have five books. Okay, the Pentateuch. The sixth book is the first book named after a man, and it's named after Joshua, which is the New Testament equivalent of the name Jesus. Joshua, Old Testament, Jesus, New Testament. So that would be Israel at its peak under that time period, and then Judges, how quick it goes down. Okay, now people see in America, or they feel, they believe that judges are ruling America. Okay, the liberal judges. Okay, and that's just a perception. It's a false perception that people have, because things that happen in courtrooms is just a facade. The whole thing's a facade. Judges come right and tell you it is their opinion. Why is your opinion not equal to theirs? It's because our opinions aren't usually backed by sheriffs and deputies. Okay? And so it's just their opinion, and most of them are pretty raunchy. Okay? And so just because a judge decrees something, that doesn't mean anything. Especially in the average person's life. Okay, I have a judgment against me. The little log cabin, it's got an injunction against it. Who cares? They said nobody's supposed to live in there. Well, Ashley was my bodyguard. She was watching the place for me. Okay, now if I try to sell it, I'm sure I'm going to have to get that injunction off. But it don't matter. Their opinion doesn't matter. Okay, and when judges decree things, that doesn't make it law. And we need to recognize that. As an American sovereign, you and I have tremendous liberty and power if we recognize that. And if we act lawfully and accordingly. Now, Judges 21, verse 25 describes the environment of Israel during the times of the judges. There are 13 judges recorded in this book, the book of Judges. And it says, and there was no king. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Okay, so what? didn't need to have a king. In fact, God didn't want them to have a king. But what was their problem as a society? Every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Okay? In the educational world, what do they call that? What is the term they call that when a society does that which is right in their own eyes? Humanism. Secular humanism. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court gave their opinion that secular humanism is a religion. They said that. And it is a religion that is the established religion of the public school systems. That is their established religion. Anything that goes contrary to that is shunned and looked down on. Their main dogma is the evolutionary theory. It is a religion, has no faith to prove it, or no facts to prove it. So it's that's a religion. Second to humanism, every man does that which is right in his own eyes. What if it's right in my eyes to kill this guy? It doesn't matter in a secular society. Okay, 1933, there's a humanist manifesto put together. Several men signed this. John Dewey was the main character. And this became the foundation of the public school system, 1933. If you read that very brief document, I think it's only a page or two, maybe two pages, maybe three, I forget. They'll use the word religion and religious more times than you find it in the Bible. In the Bible, it's found seven times, and they use it much more than that because they are religious fanatics. They had a second humanist manifesto in 1973, and a bunch of guys signed on to that. And if you read the signatures, it will be the movers and shakers of the educational society system and the political system in America. Okay? And when you take a generation from 1963 and start teaching them that you came from a monkey, guess what? They're going to start acting like it, and in fact, they're going to act worse. Okay, and that's where our culture's going. Okay, back in the 1940s, has anybody ever seen in 1948 the textbook of the Dallas Public School Systems, high school textbook? And what was taught in Dallas Public Schools was Old Testament and New Testament. 1948, I've got a copy of the book, Dallas Public Schools. And if you put that in the average Sunday school today, the adults would flunk it. Because it has some amazing information. Back in the 1940s, the problem in the public school system was basically being late to class, not putting the garbage in a garbage can, chewing gum when they weren't supposed to, and stuff like that. Today, it's drugs, perversion, shootings, pregnancies, you name it, it's going on. Why? They taught them in the 1960s. They took away the educational broad scope of, instead of teaching them that they either came from intelligent design or the evolutionary theory, that's what they used to teach, okay, where they had the Scopes trials years ago, and the guy who's defending or trying to get the evolutionary theory taught said it was bigotry to teach only one theory of the origin of the earth, and so they included the evolutionary theory. So for about 30, 40 years, they had both of those theories. And in the 1960s, they said it's bigotry to teach two theories. And they kicked God out. Okay, and then you start watching America's generation going down from then and then and then. And the up-and-coming generation. Okay, the battle that these kids are having now, the up-and-coming generation, is amazing. Okay, and these kids with these cell phones and these selfies and all these things, they are raising a generation. This generation is kids who thinks the world revolves around them and you're supposed to respect them just because they exist. Okay, that's this next generation coming up. And the ones who are going to, if the Lord tarries, and the one who wants to get a good job and move up the ladder are going to be the kids who know how to work, go to work, are faithful to work, do what they're told, and they'll move up the business ladder. And the one kid who didn't go into work to McDonald's because he didn't feel like it that day is going to be the ones to get canned. So in Judges 21, They did that which was right in our own eyes. Deuteronomy 13, verse 18 says, we are supposed to do those things that are right in the eyes of the Lord. Okay, now that verse in Judges 21, 25 is a parallel of chapter 17, 6, which is, I think, identical. Okay, so they do that which is right in their own eyes. 17, 6, same thing. So if you start at the beginning of the book of Judges, you'll have several judges in there, okay? My favorite one is Ehud. I like him. I like his techniques. Ehud was a left-handed man. He was a southpaw. He was a relief pitcher for the Cubs back in those days. Okay, the Israeli Cubs. And he went and talked to this guy named Eglon. He was a judge at the time, and Ehud was a left-hander, so he had his sword on his right side, which that generally meant, most people are right-handed, and so that generally meant that he was not going to be violent with his sword. And he went into the chamber of Eglon and said, I got a secret, I got a present I want to get you. And the guy bit into it, and he pulled out the sword and just stuck it in the guy's gut. And it says that the king was lusty. Okay, that is a nice way of saying he was fat. He was so fat that when he stuck his dagger in, the fat went around the haft of the dagger, the handle, and he couldn't pull it out. Now, I can imagine him trying to get it. Can't only lose a good sword, but, you know, time of essence, he had to get out of there. So, now, actually, what killed Eglon? Well, you say the sword. Yeah, but indirectly, what killed him? His spoon and his fork. Okay, because I don't care how fast a guy is. If I'm standing and I'm kind of watching him, he's got a sword. By the time he whips that thing out, I know guys are fast, I'm going to be ducking. This guy was so gullible. That was a good one. I showed Dad that one. Anybody watch Mark Dice on YouTube? He's got some funny stuff on YouTube. He's in California and he's telling these people that there's a group of people that wants to remove some words out of society that aren't used anymore, and one of them was gullible. And so these ladies are saying, he's making it all up, and these ladies, you think that people are gullible nowadays? Well, should we use a word? Well, yeah, I don't think they should do that. They shouldn't be gullible. And they were gullible, believing that this was actually taking place. It's pretty good stuff. Okay, but Eglon died because he wasn't vigilant. Okay, so I kind of like that story. And as you keep coming through, look at Samson. Samson is a very subtle but very wonderful picture of a very slow way that a young fella goes to the ways of the world. It's very subtle, but you read it, you'll see he hid some things from his parents. He did some things that his God wouldn't approve of. He was sneaky here. He had a friend, but he said he used him as a friend. Isn't that kind of, Samson, he's a very interesting study if a person takes some time to read through that. And if you listen to Ruckman's Ad Lib commentaries, he's got some great stuff on Samson. But then you get to chapter 17, and you got a guy who was a Levite, a priest, and he took a vow of poverty. I don't know if it's like a church today. And somebody hired him to be their priest and father. Maybe there's a church like that. I don't know. Maybe they're not. It's about 1,500 years B.C. And so he was hired to be a priest and father. He took the vow of poverty, and his mom was mad about because she had some idols and she cussed. And so I said, the people of this religion, the women are usually good cussers. And so, but I don't know if it's a church today because it's 1,500 years before BC, and that's how I did on the radio several years ago. And so now this guy kind of lost his job being a priest over one family, and he became the priest over an entire army. Maybe like World War II. That these German soldiers got actual public blessings from Catholic priests and nuns. Okay, and he was right next to the tribe of Dan. The tribe of Dan was the first one that went into apostasy. They were right next to Zidon. Zidon is where Jezebel came from, and she had vestries and vestments. Well, I don't know if it's a religion like today, but this was 1,500 years B.C. And then you get to in Judges 19. And how crazy can it get in a book of Judges? This guy has a concubine. Okay, her name is John Deere. Okay, so he has a concubine. And he goes and sees her dad, his father-in-law, or I don't know, concubine father-in-law. And he said, we need to get home. So he says, honey, we need to get going. And the dad says, no, you need to hang around, stick around. And so he stuck around for the next day. They're drinking it up and everything. And then day two, the same thing. Day three, finally, the guy says, we got to go. So he takes off. He takes off. And on his way home, they didn't have hotels, motels in those days. Usually somebody would take somebody into their house for the evening. And so he went into somebody's house for the evening. And some males of the community came in and said they wanted to know the man in a perverted way. And he declined and offered up his wife, his concubine. So they sexually abused her all night long. And in the morning when he gets up to leave, she's on the porch. And he said, let's go. And she's dead. They abused her all night long, killed her. What's his response? Cry? No, he takes a knife and he cuts her up in 12 pieces. He's a real cut up. Okay, and what did he do? He put the 12, each of the pieces in a box and went to the UPS store and sent one to each tribe. Can you imagine? Here's a head. Oh, you guessed her, Chester. Okay, so, and each of these 12 pieces went to the 12 tribes, and this caused a great stir amongst people. Obviously, would not it? And they got 11 tribes together, and they were going to go attack the Benjamites, which were the fighters. But the Benjamites were the Sodomites. They must have been the aggressive Sodomites, but they were the fighters. And the 11 tribes lost the first battle, lost the second battle, and then they had a third battle and finally won. But after they won the battle, they were not victorious in the battle. They felt sorry for the Benjamites. They said, oh, they don't got any girls that they can have to get married. So they had a Sagedy Hawkins dance. And they allowed the Benjamites to kidnap these girls to get married. Now, is that not bizarre? And as bizarre as some things are happening in America, where the soap operas people knew were fake, but people are actually living this stuff in these days. I mean, and people like Jerry Springer actually have a successful program with a bunch of absolutely nuts on there. That is a society that is living off of secular humanism. Now, Bill Grady, in one of his books, he reports in the front of it is, I forget which one it is, but he reports a bunch of absurd news reports in America. One of them was somebody in New York City saw some boys playing with a very unusual soccer ball, kicking it around and everything, and they investigated, and they unraveled what it was, and it was a skull that they were playing with as a soccer ball. That's in the United States of America. Okay, and then, of course, you got all the serial killers and all that stuff going on. That is a society that lives under secular humanism. They will not gravitate towards an animal. They will actually be worse than an animal. And if you doubt that, go to Chicago. When I was on a bus route in Chicago knocking on these doors, I would see these houses and I'd say, my pigs are more organized and cleaner than these people in Chicago. Not all of them, but a few of them. Just bizarre. How do people live like that? Okay, and so that's a society that lives on secular humanism. How bad will it get? Well, now there's a restaurant in China that they serve human meat. Not China, but Japan. And somebody just sent me an email recently about making a purse or some leather products out of human skin. Okay, and of course, if a person is an evolutionist, if they're consistent, who cares? Right? But if you realize that God made man a little lower than the angels, much higher than the animals, it is a difference. So that is the culture or society that Ruth lived in. Okay, so that's the times of the judges. Ruth lived in that. Okay, so they even, those days, they even had, you know, very famous Hollywood types. Oprah Winfrey was back then in those days. You'll see her in verse 4. She just didn't spell it with the R. Oprah Winfrey is a full-fledged New Ager. Okay? And so this is the society that Elimelech and Naomi was a part of. Okay, with that basis, we go to verse 1 of Ruth. Now, it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. Okay, so famine in the land, what land? Well, it's obviously Israel. Okay, so, you know, no bread, ran out of, no rain in the springtime, so the wheat crop went bad, barley crop went bad, didn't have bread and things like that. It could be a famine of bread like it was under Joseph. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah. Okay, so remember, Bethlehem is also called Mount Zion or Zion. Okay, and that is the birthplace of Jesus, and that is the burial site of many Israeli kings, and that is the location, or should be the location, for the Jewish temple. Bethlehem, Judah. Bethlehem, like the city, Judah, like the state. They just put it together. So there's a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab. Now notice, his intention was just to sojourn, pass through. Just passing through. Just going around looking through the, you know, culture. But notice what happened at the end of verse 2. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. Now, maybe he didn't have intentions to stay there, just to pass through, but now he stayed there. Now he is setting his roots down. So he's there. Now, why he left? Was it him? I don't know. There's no record of this. Was it Naomi? Maybe the malls weren't as exciting up there in Bethlehem, Judah. And so they wanted to go down to Moab. Maybe he lost his job and he got a job transfer. You know, where Sears leads me, that's where I will follow. Okay, and so maybe he had that. I don't know the intentions. I don't know who is the motivation behind it. Doesn't say. Naomi evidently gets bitter about the situation. So a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab. Okay, Moab would be south on the east, on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. You have Edom along Moab along the east side of the Dead Sea, and then south of that is Edom, which is the northern part of Saudi Arabia. Okay, the Moabites. Okay, Moab is a result of the relationship between Lot and his daughter. Okay, Lot was the nephew of Abraham. His daughter, and they had, after they, Sodom was blown off the map, they got daddy drunk two nights in a row. They had their own had their kids, and that became, one of them became the Moabites, and the other became the Ammonites. Okay, so this is on the east side of the Dead Sea. So he went from Bethlehem, Judah. I would say he probably curved around the north side of the Dead Sea and then came around the east side, and he's just going to go down there just to scout things out. But everybody went with him. Okay, and he went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. Now, his boys probably were teenagers about the time, because they stayed there 10 years, and so there was enough time for them to find a couple of gals, and they got married. So, now the name of the man was Elimelech. The name of his wife, Naomi. Now, that name, Naomi, okay, her name means pleasant. But when you get to the end of the chapter, she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, which means bitter. So something happened in there that caused bitterness in the heart of Naomi. So the name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah, and they came into the country of Moab and continued there. Okay, that wasn't their original intention, but that's what's happened. So in that time, 10-year time span, right here at the beginning of it, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. It doesn't say why, doesn't say how. A lot of times when you move into another culture, you and I are acquainted and conducive to our parasites. Okay, but when you go into another culture, their parasites are different than ours, and it's serious. And often causes great sickness. A lot of missionaries have great difficulties because when they drink the water of those cultures, those people are used to those parasites and we are not, and it really causes great damage to them. And so maybe that's what happened to him because he's gone from Bethlehem, Judah down to Moab. Okay, now when I went to Israel years ago, one of the things that we were advised is do not eat any fresh food, nothing fresh that they give you, no salads, anything like that. But if you do, drink a Coke afterwards. Now, that was probably the last time I had pop, per se. And the reason why they suggested that is the parasites are in the water on the vegetables, and the Coke will kill them. It'll kill everything. Even take acid off your battery. Okay, and so I did follow that advice, and I did not have the family gene or the family disease, you know, the one that runs in the genes. Okay, I didn't get that. So, praise the Lord. Okay, now the idea is that when, like Brent and Jen, okay, they're in Panama and they got to kind of get used to the parasites of Panama, the foods and everything. And so when a person travels in other cultures, you always want to drink bottled water. And that's the reason why, is because of we can easily get sick from those things. You don't want to spend your time in other cultures noticing their bathrooms more than anything. And so you want to make sure, okay, we got to understand these things. So I don't know why Elimelech died. Maybe that. I have no idea, but he died. And she was left and her two sons. Boys, upper teenage years. Okay, and they took them wives of the women of Moab. Now, if daddy was alive, and if he was a strong, staunch Jew, I don't think he would have approved of that. Jews do not think too highly of us Gentiles. But daddy's gone. And mama's probably heartbroken. And mama didn't want to fight anything. So they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name one of one was Orpah. Was that like the whale, Orpah the whale? Was there an Orpah the whale? Orca. That was Orca. Orca the whale. Or something like that. Okay, there's Orpah. And the name of the other, Ruth. And they dwelled there about 10 years. Now notice in verse 1, the intent was sojourn. Verse 2, they continued. Verse 4, they dwelled. They stuck there. 10 years. Whole decade. Okay, does anybody know any girl by the name of Orpah? Nobody knows that name. You say, why? Because of a dumb name. No, that's not the reason why. There's a bunch of dumb names in the Bible. Okay, Orpah. Anybody know any gals named Ruth? Of course. Why is this? Bible rule, Proverbs 10, verse 7, the names of the wicked shall rot. The memory of the just is blessed. This is why we will know boys named Paul and not Nero. And boys named Jacob and not any of the Caleb and Joshua, but none of the other 10 spies. Nobody knows, hears of any of those names. Okay, and you don't hear anybody. I think I've heard one person named Cain. Lot named Abel. But the general rule of thumb is people are not going to name their children Al Capone or Judas. Okay, the name, the memory of the just, of the just is blessed. The name of the wicked shall rot. Okay, nobody names their kids Ahab, but they'll name him David. Okay, and so this is a Bible rule, and that shows the conscience of parents. In America, Benedict is not a name that you hear. Benedict Arnold. You hear that over in pizzeria land, over there in Italy land, mafia land. Okay, because they don't have that Benedict Arnold like we do. Okay, they'll have their certain names. So we have two gals, okay, Orpah and Ruth. Now they're married. They must have been bad cooks because Mahlon and Chilion died. Wow. When Naomi was leaving, if she was the instigator of them moving, dear, our credit card bills are too high. You got to get a good job. I hear the steel mills are hiring down there in Moab. Okay, if she would have been the one behind that, she would have never dreamed in less than 10 years she's going to be a widow and no boys. Never would have dreamed that. Who knows if that would have happened if they would have stayed in Bethlehem, Judah. The story doesn't say. God doesn't say. Okay, and so here these boys probably only married a year or two. And for Ruth's sake, which obviously they didn't buy life insurance. So she didn't get a good payout upon their death because she was very poor. Had to work and provide for her mother-in-law. So, verse 5, Mahlon and Chilion died, also both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Very sad situation. So, what does she decide? Okay. Then she arose with her daughter and son-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she heard in the country of Moab how that the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. What was her motivation for coming back? Yeah. Yeah. Was she coming back for the Lord, or was she coming back for the bread? Man's stomach. The belly. And that could be insight, and I'm not saying it is, but it could be an insight of who was a driving factor of getting out of the will of God. Okay, for my belly. Okay, or for whatever. Who knows for certain? Don't know. Now she's going to go back home. Now, under the Jewish laws, because they were in Bethlehem, Judah, I don't know if they rented out their property or whatever, but their property was still there. It's still theirs. It's still part of the inheritance. So they're going to be able to come back to that property. So it's 10 years, so obviously they haven't gone through the Jubilee. Okay, so that's significant. Verse 7, wherefore she went forth out of the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return in the land of Judah. So they get ready to take off. They've got the U-Haul behind the donkey, and they got all their stuff in there. And it's just a trailer because they got very little stuff. They don't have a whole truck. It's just very little. They lost about everything, and they're heading back. And right before they get ready heading back, she sees the two girls, and they said, why don't you stay home? This is your culture. I'm telling you, you ought to stay home. Now, the response to that is, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each to your mother's house. I don't know why she said mother's house. I would think she'd say father's house, but even at that, maybe he's dead. Unless she's a women's liber, I don't know. Go return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you. Well, praise the Lord. She's got the Lord mentioned. As ye have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant you that ye may find rest. Each of you in the house of her husband. So she's encouraging him to remarry. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. And they said unto her, surely we will return with thee unto thy people. Okay, so you have two ladies who are pledging their loyalty, and they as two say, we're going back with you. One of them meant it, one of them didn't. And time tells who did and who didn't. Naomi said, turn again, my daughters, why will you go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Now, that's a Jewish custom. And so that's what she's saying. If you're going to wait for me to have another boy, forget it. First off, don't get a husband. Don't plan to get anything. Besides, you're going to wait 20 years anyway. Can you imagine being a boy in that situation? Whew. I tell you, in the Jewish customs, when the firstborn dies, you know, say the firstborn gets married and he dies and they don't have children, then she's got to marry the secondborn. I guarantee the secondborn is going to be very interested in the courting pattern of the firstborn. And that secondborn's going to say, man, she's a dog. You got to get somebody else. Okay, but again, that's Jewish customs. Okay, so she says, turn again, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have an husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have an husband also tonight, it should also bear sons. Would ye tarry for them till they are grown? Would ye stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieveth me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. Okay, that's an Old Testament phrase. It's like he's giving her a backhand. And they lifted up their voice and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. So I want to come back to the hand of the Lord, but Ruth clave unto her. Ruth is going to demonstrate how to cleave to the Lord. And we can learn a lot from that. Now, cleave is an English word that has opposite meanings, where you have a trio of sightless rodents, and the agricultural farmer's wife severed the appendage of the sightless rodent's tail with her cleaver. Okay, so that's the intellectual saying, three blind mice. Okay, so a cleaving is to cut and separate something in one fashion, but for a husband and wife, to cleave is to stick together. So Ruth is going to demonstrate by her example, how to do that. Now, we can look at that as a believer of how to cleave to the Lord. It doesn't matter what people say. If mama says, go back to your land, I'm cleaving to the Lord. You're not going to talk me out of it. And she didn't talk her out of it. Okay, it's also an example how you and I can cleave to the Lord. It's an example how husband and wife can cleave to each other. So it's a wonderful picture in the Bible of cleaving to the Lord and cleaving to one's spouse or cleaving to the Bible. Okay, where Naomi, even her loved one, could not talk her out of her desire to cleave unto her. And that's a wonderful testimony. So we'll stop there, verse 13 and 14. Any questions or comments?